Welcome everyone who's watching this live, and those of you who are joining us after the fact, the magic of recording. This is Econ 730, very advanced class, and it's the Office Hours 2 session of the Keynes, Krugman, and the Crisis course. And we've got some questions right off the bat. Before I answer the questions, let me say one general announcement. Excuse me. I'm going to send an email out to everybody once I decide on the exact time, but this coming Wednesday's lecture, let me look at the date to make sure I'm saying this right. So Wednesday, July 13th, which would be lecture 3 of Keynes and Krugman, I am going to Freedom Fest, and my plane lands. I'm going to have the lecture on the same day, but I think we should just push it back. And so I'll send out an email to give you the specifics. My guess is if I do it in an hour, that should be enough time, because it's when my plane lands. I'm just not sure I can get to the hotel and get checked in and then get my internet up and running in time to start the lecture on time. So I think it'd be safer if I just push it back a little bit. So again, it'll be the same day and everything. It might start later than the normal time. So that's this coming Wednesday, lecture 3. And I will, like I say, send out an email today, Saturday, to give you guys the exact details about that. So sorry if that messes your guys' schedule up, but that was the only flight that made sense for me to get to Freedom Fest. Okay. Benjamin says, it seems that the general theory is a handbook for market manipulation. I reference Keynes on page 382 saying that a gold standard doesn't allow for the government to mitigate economic distress. Would a 100% gold-backed currency and 100% reserve requirements make this whole argument moot? What is going to cause a crisis in that scenario, and why is it thought that mitigation is the better solution? There's a lot of stuff here, Benjamin. And this is fine, Benjamin, since this is the point of office hours and there's not that many people signing right now. Just so I understand it, do you intend this to be one long question, or are these separate questions that you want me to answer independently of each other? Okay. Benjamin says several. Okay. And again, that's fine. I just want to make sure I understand how you're intending these. Okay. So for that first one, again, Benjamin's saying the general theory seems like a handbook for market manipulation, and what if there were 100% gold-backed currency with 100% reserve requirements, would this make it moot? So, yeah, you're right. Keynes is quite comfortable with being an interventionist. And if you guys have done the reading yet for week 3, where in particular I assigned, in terms of the mandatory readings, like a general restatement of the general theory that he gives. I think it's chapter 18. I think it's 18. And then the last one, which is, I believe, 24, and I'm just saying those off the top of my head, consult your syllabus to make sure I'm saying the right numbers. But that last one that notes on the social philosophy that the general theory would lead you to, yeah, I mean, he tries to take it back, right? And we'll talk about this, of course, in lecture 3. But it's in the beginning, I mean, he's just casually, oh, yeah, we should socialize investment and we should do this and that. And then he tries to take it back saying, well, don't get me wrong, I'm still a classical liberal, and we can still allow individual initiative and stuff within this broad framework once the government sets the general parameters. It's hard to know, but clearly he has no problem with the government coming in and doing things as long as Keynes and other smart people like him think, well, that's clearly what's necessary here. So yeah, he has no problem with the principle of the government intervening in the economy at all. As far as the gold standard, so yeah, there's two things going on here. On the one hand, why is it that they think, and they meaning Keynesians, why do they think gold is so silly? Well, you know, a gold standard. Well, because as Keynes says, that if you think part of the problem is that the rate of interest can be too high, then the gold standard sort of ties your hands. Because if you're trying to manipulate the economy, how is it that you're going to push down the rate of interest? Well, the obvious way is to just print more money and inject it right into the financial sector, into the banking system. And so not only Keynes, but even Paul Krugman recently talked about the fact that the reason, and this may even be in some of the readings I gave from Krugman that we'll cover in subsequent weeks in this course, saying that the problem was the reason the early 1930s got so awful compared to what happened this time around in the, you know, after 2008, is that this time around Ben Bernanke was able to just inject a massive amount of liquidity, whereas in the early 30s the Fed's hands were relatively tied, because if they devalued the dollar too much, if they printed too many dollars trying to help things, then the dollar price of gold would go up above the official price of $20.67 per ounce, and so there'd be an arbitrage profit. People would be able to go up to the government, U.S. government, and say, "Here's $20.67. Give me an ounce of gold, because you guys are on the gold standard. And that's what you say you'll do," and then turn around and sell it in the open market for whatever, $22 an ounce. Okay, so if you wanted to stay on the gold standard, you couldn't just inflate with reckless abandon. And of course, that's the whole point of the gold standard. It makes it so the government can't inflate with reckless abandon. That's its virtue. That's not a problem, according to the Austrians and other supporters of the gold standard. So back to Benjamin's question, he's saying, isn't the whole problem, at least from the Austrian perspective, that there was this discretionary monetary policy? And so the reason we're in these boom-bust cycles is that there's not 100% gold-backed currency with 100% reserve requirement, and so that's why we have the boom-bust cycle, and then we're occasionally in a massive slump where Keynesians come along and misdiagnose why we're in the slump and then say, oh my gosh, we need to be able to print a bunch of money, otherwise we're going to have massive unemployment for a few years, and oh shoot, this gold standard's not letting us print a bunch of money. So you're exactly right, Benjamin, that just to rephrase all that, say it again in different words, I personally agree with, and certainly Ludwig von Mises, Friedrich Hayek, and Murray Rothbard, and Joe Salerno, Tom Woods, other modern Austrians, certainly in the Rothbardian tradition, and even, I was going to say even the free banking guys, except they don't think you need 100% reserve requirement, but certainly all the guys in the Rothbardian tradition would definitely agree that, yeah, if we had 100% backed commodity money, it doesn't have to be gold, it could be silver or whatever commodity the market chose, but yeah, if the government backed up the dollar 100% by some commodity, and then on top of that also had 100% reserve requirements, so there's not fractional reserve banking, then there would not be the business cycle anymore in the modern sense of that term. I mean, there could still be, it would be an empirical question. I imagine some years the economy would grow more than other years. I mean, it would just be literally the exact same type of economic growth year after year. Entrepreneurial error would be more or less in some years than others, but the idea that there could be a massive bubble that would then pop and then unemployment would go up to 10% and be stuck there for a year, and that would not happen, according to us, because we subscribe to the Austrian business cycle theory. And so if interest rates are generally the correct market rate, which they would be if you didn't have the government and the commercial banking system able to expand the quantity of money and contract it very quickly, then there couldn't be an artificial boom, and then there wouldn't be a bust period to liquidate the mistakes of the boom. And so there wouldn't be these massive periods where, in the short term, it would appear to naive Keynesians, oh, if only we could print up a bunch of money, then we'd be fine, or that would at least stop the bleeding. So I agree with you, Benjamin, in that. And let me just clarify for people who are newcomers to the Austrian approach, in case you don't know what we're talking about, if you need to go read up on Austrian business cycle theory, I mean, I will probably cover the raw basics of it in this course, this Keynes course, week four. Is that week four, I think, when we're talking about Hayek and so forth, and their response to the crisis. Because that's the point at which I will start rebutting some of the stuff. So the first 3 weeks, week two and week three, I'm just trying to give you guys an understanding of what Keynes is saying. So I'm sort of remaining silent in the main lectures about my own views of what he's talking about. But then I think it's in week four when we're formally discussing the letters that Hayek and other people sent to the London Times and so forth. So that's where I'll have the opportunity to give you guys the Austrian objection to a lot of the stuff that we've been going over up to that point in the course. So I will talk about Austrian business cycle theory there, but here, let me just say briefly, if you have never really seen that spelled out, just you can maybe Google it would be one of my Mises.org articles, stuff like the Fed, like empirical evidence the Fed caused the housing bubble, something like that. That should pull up an article, and then I have tons of links within that. If you can just find one of my Mises.org articles where I'm talking about the housing bubble and the Fed, then I should have a ton of links in there to get you up to speed if that's what you want to do in terms of the basics of Austrian business cycle theory. But why, in case you don't know, is why Benjamin was saying you need to have 100% reserve requirements in addition to 100% gold-backed currency. That distinction, just to spell that out, to say 100% gold-backed currency means whatever so to be gold-backed means that you're on a gold standard, means if you take dollars into the government, you can exchange them for a certain weight of gold. Okay, so that's what it means to say your currency is backed by gold. To say 100% backed gold currency means that the government has in its possession enough gold to be able to redeem every outstanding dollar at the official rate. Okay, so there can't be a run on the dollar in the sense that, well, gee, what if so many people start trying to churn their dollars for gold that the gold reserves get dangerously low and then the government has to devalue the dollar? Okay, that can't happen if they've got enough actual gold set aside to literally redeem every dollar in the world that exists at that moment. So that's what it would mean to have 100% gold backed dollar. And then on top of that, I guess it's related to that is to say 100% reserve requirements means the commercial banks also, if they have checking account balances that are denominated in U.S. dollars, then they need to have either enough gold in the vault or enough Federal Reserve notes, actual currency, or reserves with the Fed itself to back that up. Okay, so again, the you still have the Fed. The Fed would say what we are directly able to control as the Federal Reserve is how many green pieces of paper there are, the $20 bills, $100 bills with pictures of U.S. presidents, and how many reserve balances actual commercial banks have with us. All right, so those are electronic deposits. You know, there's just a number in a computer somewhere, but the Fed's keeping track of and saying, okay, these banks legally could come to us and say, we want to withdraw our reserve balances with you, and then they could just tell the Treasury, fire up the printing press, because these people want to take out $100,000. Citibank wants to withdraw $100,000 from its checking account with us, the Fed. Okay, so the Fed or the Treasury or whoever the agency is needs to have enough gold to be able to back up the green pieces of paper and then the commercial banks own checking account reserves with the Fed. That's what the 100% gold-backed dollar is. And then to take it one step further, you would say, and now even the commercial checking or the commercial banks, if Joe Blow has a regular old checking account with a bank, and he goes to the ATM and he looks at his balance and it says on the screen, you've got $1,000 in here. Well, that bank has to have $1,000 either in literal currency in its vault or its checking account balance with the Fed. So that therefore, for every dollar out there, whether it's a green piece of paper or just someone's checking account balance with his commercial bank, there exists that amount of physical gold in the possession of the U.S. government or the Fed backing it up. That's the idea. So that's not true right now. first of all, there's no gold, but even beyond that, commercial banks inflate on top of even what the Fed creates, in case people don't realize that. So that's why there's the two-pronged thing there in Benjamin's question. And that's also why even when the government, even when we were on a gold standard in the United States, that's why Austrian business cycle theory was still relevant. We still had boom-bust cycles. Because a lot of people say, you Austrians are clearly idiots. The U.S. was on a gold standard until 1933. So you guys say, oh, if we go back on gold, that'll fix everything. No, it won't. You guys are morons. And that's the Austrians are fully aware of history, and they know that there were business cycles before 1933. It was, though, that even though they were on a gold standard, it wasn't 100% gold standard, and there was still fractional reserve banking. And so the commercial banking system could inflate, could increase the quantity of money in the system just by making loans that were not fully backed up by whatever the commodity money was. And so that would make the interest rate go down to be able to get those loans out the door, and so that would stimulate an artificial boom, according to Mises. Okay, let's see. So Ben's got a bunch of other questions. And for those people who are also tuned in here, as always, if you have other questions, go ahead and post them. You don't have to wait till I'm done answering Ben's question, because that will influence how long I take to answer a given question, seeing what's in the queue. Okay, Benjamin says, can you give a synopsis of the Austrian view on full employment and involuntary unemployment? Sure. This can be pretty quick. Mises is pretty explicit in Human Action, and I say this because we just covered it in the most recent Rothbard Graduate Seminar, and it was funny. Mises was so dogmatic, if you will, that even Walter Block was objecting and sort of arguing with the rest of us in the faculty, saying, this is just not correct. Mises shouldn't have said this. And we were trying to, like, give the context and the nuance and to say, well, and this is the sense in which Mises is saying that, and I think that's okay. And he was saying, no, but just the sentence is wrong. So the claim that Mises made was saying, in the market economy, everyone who is unemployed does so voluntarily. That the only reason you are unemployed in the market economy is that you have decided you don't want to work for the prevailing wage rates, and that anybody who wants to can get a job so long as he's willing to accept whatever the prevailing wage rate is. All right, and so Mises literally says anybody who's unemployed in the market economy does so as a voluntary choice, that there's no such thing as involuntary unemployment in the market economy. So the way Mises would explain what we mean nowadays by, oh, man, what's up with all this unemployment, where, you know, if you prod people and you say, well, what do you mean exactly? Are you talking about, like, a guy quitting his job and trying to switch industries? And he's just, you know, or somebody who gets laid off and he could go work flipping burgers, but he thinks, no, I can get a better job if I just look for a few months and I'm going to live off my savings. People, you know, when you start getting those nuances, people would say, oh, okay, well, that's not really what we mean by unemployment. We're talking about Obama should do something about unemployment. We mean people who are perfectly happy to take jobs and they're just, you know, they just can't find anything. And so that's the standard Austrian view on that, yes, is that the only reason that can happen is that wage rates, for some reason, are being held above the market clearing level. Because, again, just looking at – so the Austrians take a very micro approach to it and just say the labor market is a market, like the Apple market, and so how do you explain it? Well, you got your supply and demand curves, and the demand for labor is by employers, and that's a downward-sloping curve. So if the wage rate goes down, the quantity demanded of labor goes up, right? And – the supply curve is upward sloping, at least, you know, in over long stretches, because you can get into weird situations with labor where if you're paying somebody $1 million an hour, they're probably not going to work 40 hours a week, because, you know, after they get $10 million in the bank, they're probably just going to go on vacation. So there, you know, if you're going to draw that, it would look like the labor supply curve would be upward sloping for a while, and then it would wrap back on itself. But in terms of the the whole market where you're throwing everybody in there, at least for the relevant ranges of what the wage rate is, you would think of over the market as a whole, the supply curve would be upward sloping. The more you're offering people to work, the more work that would be forthcoming. So if you had those assumptions, you just put the two curves together, there's a wage rate that balances the quantity supplied and demanded of labor. And so what is unemployment? Unemployment is simply a glut of labor, where there's more workers trying to sell labor than the quantity of labor that employers want to hire. And so what does that mean? Well, duh, it means the wage rate's too high. It's above the market clearing level. If the wage rate came down, two things would happen. Employers would be willing to purchase more labor, because now it's cheaper per unit, and not as many people would want to work as many hours. Some people would drop off. And so, and just to explain that, people, well, no, people got to eat. No matter what the wage rate is, people got to work. Well, no, that's not true. There's lots of people in the labor force that are, for example, maybe the spouse of the major breadwinner. And so, you know, let's say there's a couple, and just, you know, I won't even be sexist. Let's say the woman is the primary breadwinner. She's like a lawyer or something. She's got a great job, and the husband is a painter or something, and he just does stuff on the side and occasionally sells a portrait on eBay or something like that, or, you know, he has an exhibit he's a part of every year, and then he makes a few thousand dollars a year doing that. Now, if the wage rate at McDonald's all of a sudden goes up to $20 an hour, well, they would probably say, well, gee, honey, why don't you go do that? Flip burgers for $20 an hour, because that's pretty good money, and you can do that. But if it pays $8 an hour, then they would talk, and the wife would say, nah, honey, don't bother doing it. I make enough money for us to, you know, pay the mortgage and everything. Just you stay around the house and tend to our garden and, you know, do projects around the house, like put up new wallpaper or something or whatever. That makes more sense for you to do that rather than go out and waste your time flipping burgers for $8 an hour. But again, if McDonald's were paying $20 an hour, maybe he would do that. That, you know, the extra money they'd bring in would make sense for him to do that and then hire some, you know, outside guys to come in and put up the wallpaper in their house. Okay, so that kind of thing, I picked a very contrived example to make the point. But what I'm saying is it's not true that over in the economy as a whole, every single person who's in the labor force at any given time needs to work exactly that many hours regardless of the wage. That's just simply not true. That more people will do other things besides formally working for money payment if the wage rate goes down. And so if that's your analysis, and this, of course, is what John Maynard Keynes would disparage as a very quaint, naive, micro, classical analysis of the labor market, well then, duh, if there's massive unemployment in the sense that we mean the term, the solution is the wage rate comes down, and that clears the market. Problem solved. So why is it that that's not happening? And there's lots of different explanations. So I think most Austrians would say ultimately it's because of things like unions, and even there, it's not voluntary unions, because if it were all voluntary, that's just a choice, right? That if you're part of a union and you say to the employer, no, we want to get $30 an hour for our workers, and at $30 an hour, that labor market, at least in that particular, you know, for that type of labor and whatever, so it's a subset of the whole labor market, if that's not clearing, you know, if it's a union of carpenters and 10% of the carpenters can't get work because the carpenters union is insisting on too high of a wage rate, but they're all voluntarily agreeing to it, you know, and it's just they're saying to the employer, this is what it's going to be, and all the unemployed carpenters, they don't go to the employer and say, we're willing to work for less than the other carpenters, because, no, they're all part of the union, and they want to be, you know, solidarity with their union brothers or sisters, could be female carpenters. That's voluntary, okay? So that's not what the Austrians are talking about. They would say, yeah, well, you're free. You know, it's not stopping you from dropping that union and then going working as a scab. You can do that. Now, what's not voluntary is if the union lets it be known that if we catch anybody trying to undercut the union wage demand and work for the employer for less than what we're insisting on in our negotiations, we're going to have thugs come and beat you up. Or we'll have guys with picket signs standing outside the factory, and if we see any so-called scabs show up trying to sneak in and work for less than what we're asking, we're actually going to beat you up, right? And that happens. So that, of course, is not voluntary. So that's one thing. And then the other, of course, is just institutional government policies, like, for obviously, minimum wage laws. That explains why unemployment is so high among unskilled workers, is because it's literally illegal for the market clearing wage rate to prevail. So there's no mystery there as to why there's unemployment among, you know, teenagers, especially like in the inner city. And then the other thing is unemployment insurance. So if the government is sending out checks paying you when you don't have a job and you're applying for unemployment benefits, well, then it's not surprising that people take longer looking for new work. And so that's and that's not even a strictly Austrian point. I mean, even the mainstream economists who won the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics, I think it was, what was it, in 2010, I think, if I'm not getting mixed up, it was like three of them that they had done search models within the labor market, and that was one of the obvious things they found, that if you're viewing the labor market as one where there's people, you know, that a problem of finding an employer who has a job that you want at an acceptable wage, and then the employer is also searching for qualified applicants who are willing to work for what the employer can offer, in the real world, that's a difficult search problem. It's not just a matter of drawing some curves and seeing where they intersect on the blackboard. In the real world, that's why there's a formal search process, and the employers might have multiple rounds of interviews. And if you're trying to get a job, you make your resume up and you email it to a million people. You maybe apply to Monster.com. You do all this stuff. You go to a temp agency. Right? So in the real world, it's a difficult problem to match up suitable employers and employees with each other. And so when you start formally modeling that, which is what these Nobel laureates did, one of the obvious things that happens is as a worker trying to get a job, you have to make a guess as to if I were to, you know, let's say you get an offer. Well, you don't just say necessarily, oh, well, yeah, I'm going to take this because this is the best thing I'm going to get. You don't know what the best thing you're going to get is. So you have to decide, and again, in their models, they do it more formally with mainstream neoclassical economic approach. You know, it's a mathematical model. But they'll say, okay, well, there's a certain distribution of offers I'm going to get with this, you know, the probability with. And so you say they can do an optimization problem and say, as a worker, I'm going to keep searching for jobs until I get an offer that's at least this good. So, you know, like I'm going to hold out until I get a job offer offering at least $75,000 in this particular line of work. Or, you know, that, and you could be more specific, and has this much vacation time and blah, blah, blah. And so if somebody comes along and gives you that, you take the job. Even though you know it's possible if you searched longer, you would find an offer for $80,000, but the point is you might not. Or, you know, every month that you're not working, that you're devoting to sending out your resume and flying to places for interviews, is another month that you're burning your savings, or that you're living off of your parents or whatever it is you're doing to support yourself while you don't have a job. And so the point is there is a trade-off there, and you don't hold out for the best possible job offer you're going to get, because it might take you 2 years of searching to find it. When you get a job offer that's acceptable, you take it. So the point is, in that calculation as to how long should you be willing to hold out looking for a really good job offer, obviously one of the primary considerations is how much savings do you have. And so if the government's sending you checks every month, or whatever they send it to you, every 2 weeks or something, paying you when you don't have a job, which we call unemployment benefits, you're obviously rationally going to raise the threshold as to what is the minimally acceptable job offer I'm going to get before I say yes. All right, so that's just, when you set the problem up like that, obviously that just pops out. So it's not a sinister thing. It's not that we're saying these people on the dole are a bunch of lazy bums watching, you know, Let's Make a Deal all day. even if they really were busting their butt going to the library and going on the free internet connections and printing out job offers and you know, and they were just doing interviews 5 times a week and what have you, even if they were doing that, the point is rationally they should be willing to engage in a longer search to find a better job if they had, you know, somebody supporting them while they did that, as opposed to if the government didn't send them checks, they would have to you know, settle and compromise and take the best offer they had after maybe 2 months, as opposed to waiting for 8 months after they get laid off. Okay, so that's, so the Austrians also talk about that. So there, I mean, that's a little bit tricky. Technically, that would be voluntary unemployment. But in the modern parlance, we would actually, you know, those people, we count them as unemployed. When we say right now that the unemployment rate is 9.2% or whatever the official number is, that's including people who are currently getting paid by the government who are looking for work. All right, so the dividing line between voluntary and involuntary unemployment actually gets blurred in practice because, you know, if you used to work at a law firm as a partner and then you went off on your own or something and then things didn't work out and now you're trying to get another job in the legal industry and you're used to making $200,000 a year, even if you could technically go down to Home Depot and be a cashier and earn $20,000 a year, you might not take that. And so, you know, it's, people might say, well, that's not a serious job offer for this kind of person. So come on, let's be serious. He's not involuntarily unemployed. So that's, like I said, there's no real cut and dry distinction between some of these things. So anyway, that would be the way the Austrians would discuss it. So they would say, if you want to clear the labor market, if you want to get rid of this massive institutional unemployment, get rid of the minimum wage law, stop having the government look the other way when unions beat the heck out of people. and incidentally, a different way of approaching that would be, because a lot of even Austrians are saying, whether they say it in so many words, that government intervention to send in armed guys to help protect employer property from union violence is necessary, and that's not really even true. The free market could easily allow for employers to protect so-called scabs. You know, they could just have truck them in armored personnel carriers. It's just that would be illegal right now. If, you know, if you're running a factory and there's a bunch of union marchers outside protesting with picket signs and they're kind of looking intimidating, and you know that the people are afraid to come to your factory to work because they might get beaten up by the union guys, you obviously, it would be worth your time as an employer to just pay several thousand dollars and develop security measures, like, you know, have guys come in with you know, bulletproof vests on and stuff and big you know, the riot gear that police have with, you know, shields that are bulletproof and so forth that are, you know, man-sized, and come in and just throw tear gas and disperse the protesters and get them out of there without actually, you know, physically hurting them. And then you could, like I say, have Hummers come in there, you know, if you wanted to, with a guy placed on top with a machine gun and ship in, trucking your alternate workforce. But they can't do that right now because that's illegal. The government would come along and say, whoa, 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 you can't be using tear gas and stuff to disperse protesters outside your factory. That's what we do. That's our job, is to disperse mobs. And we decided, so it's not that actually we need the government to protect the employers from union thugs. It's that we need the government to stop selectively interfering and saying, we're going to use our monopoly of might to make sure employers don't protect themselves, and yet we're going to look the other way when union guys are beating up scabs. Okay, and then of course, getting rid of unemployment benefits and all that stuff. So the Austrians generally think if you did all that, yes, there would still be boom-bust cycles if we had a fiat currency with fractional reserve banking, but the slumps would be liquidated fairly quickly. There's a two-pronged thing there. In the Austrian view, you have a boom-bust cycle because of the central bank and fractional reserve banking. But the reason the slump can take a long time to get over, the reason you could have massive unemployment year after year after year, is because the government then cripples the response of the market to the prior boom period. Right? So left to its own devices, the market would be able to recover from these malinvestments in the boom period fairly quickly, like within 8 to 12 months. It's just that the government has all these other things in place, too, that cripple it. Okay, let's move on here. Okay, and it looks like Benjamin, you're the only one posting questions, so you're the man of the hour here. Okay, and again, we've had more people log in. If you have a question, go ahead and post it, and I'll take less time per question that's in the queue to get to yours. So Ben says, why is it that Keynes is the hero of the elitist economist? Are there examples of how it has worked successfully in history? According to a Rasmussen poll, there is little support for Keynes in mainstream America. Okay. Well, look, Keynes, I don't want to ruffle you guys. I think Keynes was a genius, and I don't use that term lightly. Okay, I mean, Murray Rothbard was a genius, Ludwig von Mises was a genius. But when I use the term genius, I don't just mean, oh, somebody that I think is pretty smart. I mean somebody who is not only very smart, but also is brilliant and is creative and comes up with new ways of looking at stuff that other people hadn't thought of. So I do think Keynes was a genius in that respect. There's a lot of wisdom and just brilliant insight in the general theory. Not so much the stuff that we're reading, but like his chapter on interest. And then so he's got two back-to-back chapters. One is called like the general theory of interest, and the next one's called the classical theory of interest. I personally think that he's on the right track there. In my own dissertation, I go down a path that's very similar to what Keynes is doing in the general theory in terms of his just neutral economic analysis of what interest is in a market economy and what determines interest rates and so on. Obviously, I don't subscribe to his policy conclusions from that analysis, but the point is, in terms of explaining what interest is, I think he, you know, makes a lot of good points there. So he was a very sharp guy. So to answer your question, I think the reason, Benjamin, is that a lot of economists believe that Keynes did what he claims to have done in the general theory, that he came along and presented a more comprehensive model of how the economy works, and that it encompassed all of economics up to that point as a special case of full employment. So in the sense of, why do most physicists now think Albert Einstein was a genius? Well, for the same reason. I mean, Einstein came along and came up with a model that could explain more stuff in the world, and as a special case, contained all the truth that was in Newtonian mechanics or classical mechanics. And so they would say the same thing with Keynes. And then to say, has it ever worked? Well, you have to realize what most economists believe is that the Great Depression was the downfall of orthodox classical free market economics. They thought that Say's law was demonstrably refuted in the 1930s. So I don't agree with that, because as we pointed out already in some of the lectures in this course, and then we'll maybe talk a little bit more about in week four. In response to the great crash of 1929, governments and central banks did all sorts of extraordinary, unprecedented things. So that was hardly a test of laissez-faire economics. And of course, when the governments and central banks did all those interventions, they had the worst, most sluggish recovery in world history. Whereas in earlier crises or panics, when the central governments and central banks were very less interventionist, things recovered more quickly. So So, yeah, from our point of view, we'd say, what are you talking about? Empirically, isn't it clear that Keynesianism is garbage? But that's not the way most mainstream economists interpret history. Most mainstream economists actually think that Herbert Hoover, when things got hairy, tried to balance the budget. When in fact, no, he ran massive, unprecedented peacetime deficits for a few years, and then very slightly tried to balance the budget by jacking up tax rates and cutting spending a little bit. And they think that's a refutation of the free market, which is crazy. All right, so, and they also think that the Fed didn't do anything in the early 30s because it was worried about maintaining its gold reserves, when as we've seen, no, the Fed repeatedly slashed interest rates down to record lows, and then, yeah, it's true, in the fall of 1931, they had to start raising rates because of a gold exodus, but they had already been doing stimulative, counter-cyclical, Keynesian-type policies for 2 years or a year and a half at that point, and things just kept getting worse and worse and worse. So to answer your question, modern economists who I think have not studied much history just take the standard narrative at face value that says we had a bunch of laissez-faire policies in place. Unemployment went up to 25% under Herbert Hoover. FDR came in, took us off the gold standard, started engaging in massive government spending and other interventions, and then look what happened. The economy bottomed out, unemployment started dropping. And then finally, how did we ultimately get out of the Depression was because of the spending of World War II. So, you know, Paul Krugman has said that explicitly, that World War II got us out of the Depression because the government finally was forced to spend enough money to raise aggregate demand to where it needed to be. And that's ultimately how we got out. So he would say, yeah, the New Deal was good, at least the spending aspects of it. It was better than nothing, but it wasn't enough. So it was enough to start pulling us back from the brink of destruction, but to finally get us back into regular territory in terms of the economy, we needed the massive spending of World War II. So Krugman, in his mind, thinks there's a clear-cut example of Keynesianism. Also, and we'll get into this more when we talk about Krugman, but just so you understand why Krugman thinks Keynesianism has been empirically validated, if you watch that thing that I posted, the optional lecture, for I think it was for this week three, about Paul Krugman talking about Keynesianism. It's only like 55 minutes, but there you'll get a definite sense, at least if you're baffled, Benjamin, as to how can people think Keynes is so great. This stuff about interest rates. So Krugman says, look, in the Keynesian framework, what can happen, the reason you can get stuck in a liquidity trap, and we'll talk more about that in week five, I believe, what can happen is the nominal interest rate that would be necessary to ensure full employment could negative. And yet in the real world, you can't charge less than 0% nominally for interest. And so what's happening there is that there's too much saving going on relative to investment opportunities. And so that's why there's, you know, saying that the market clearing interest rate would be negative, because the lower you push the interest rate, the less savings there is, the more investment. And so people, instead of saving so much, are going to go out and consume more. So that's going to raise aggregate demand. And also the lower the interest rate, the more investment spending there is, and that raises aggregate demand. Right, so the problem then is if the interest rate is stuck at 0% because of just that fact that people aren't going to lend money at a negative interest rate, they would just sit on the cash. That's why Krugman says the U.S. government was able to come in and engage in humongous deficit spending without pushing up interest rates. He's saying because really the interest rate wanted to be negative 4%. And so, yeah, when the government comes in, the U.S. government, and runs a $1.6 trillion deficit, it's true, that does push up the interest rate relative to what it otherwise would have been. But if that really just means the market clearing interest rate went from being negative 5% to now being negative 1%, you would still, looking out in the world, just see the interest rate hovering around 0% because it couldn't reach negative 5% and it still can't reach negative 1%. And so Krugman is saying that was a clear-cut demonstration, and he's correct that a lot of right-wing guys, myself included, were concerned, and I still am concerned about interest rates skyrocketing. I just think that it's been, we're in the sort of weird bubble of treasuries where because the Fed's buying it and so forth. So I think treasuries are in a bubble right now, meaning that interest rates on U.S. government debt are ridiculously low. So I do think at some point there could be a crash in the dollar and in U.S. treasuries, meaning that interest rates are going to spike, U.S. interest rates. But Krugman doesn't think so. He thinks it's fine. He thinks this is the normal correct price, that really the yield on U.S. government debt ought to be negative 2% or something, and that's why we're seeing what we're seeing. So Krugman explicitly says in that interview or that lecture he gave that we've got as an optional thing for you guys to watch here, that that's kind of extraordinary, that Keynes, in this analysis from 1936, is more astute than just about every policymaker today and all the economists from Chicago and these Austrian idiots, because these guys are all trapped in their conventional supply and demand for loanable funds framework, where they think, well, gee, if the interest rate right now is such and such, and the U.S. government comes in and borrows $1.5 trillion a year and pledges to keep doing that, that's going to push up interest rates. And yet it apparently didn't. That interest rates, the yield on U.S. government debt right now is still very low, even though they've been running massive deficits. So Krugman thinks this is an open and shut case. What more do you need to see that the Keynesian analysis is correct and these right-wingers are nuts? All right, so that's and like I say, when we cover this stuff more formally in the subsequent weeks, I will give you a better response as to what does the free market economist say to this stuff. But for right now, I'm just answering your question. That's why they think Keynes is right. And they also would say, you know, they think the stimulus worked. They think that the economy was heading in 2008, was on a downward spiral, and that the government and the Fed hadn't done anything, unemployment would have gone up to 20%, and it would have been another Great Depression. And they said, but fortunately, Bernanke did a bunch of stuff, and, you know, we had TARP, and we had the Obama stimulus package, which was too little. So that's why we're still stuck in this rut, but it's not as bad as it was in the 1930s because we spent more money than the government did in the 1930s. That's what they would say. So in their mind, duh, what more evidence do you need? Okay, Benjamin says, how much esteem should a student give to an economics Nobel Prize winner? How relevant is it? It's hard to say. For one thing, and you may already know this, Benjamin, I'm just pointing out for people. Strictly speaking, the original Nobel Prize that was set up by, what's his name, Alfred Nobel, did not include economics. So that's why now you might occasionally hear me say the Nobel Memorial Prize, because if you go and Google it and look it up, what Hayek and Samuelson and you know all these guys, Paul Krugman, are actually winning is Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics that's issued by a bank, and it's not actually the Nobel Prize, but the way the Peace Prize is the Nobel Prize. So just one little tidbit there. I'm not going to win the Nobel Prize in economics because I'm not in academia, right? So they can't – well, I say they can't. I am still flabbergasted that they gave the Nobel Peace Prize to Barack Obama. And not because I care about his politics or anything, but just because he hadn't done anything. I mean, that's just stunning to me. I mean, the Nobel Peace Prize is supposed to be for people who have accomplished something. And I mean, that would be like me saying, I'm going to do all this great stuff in physics and then getting a Nobel Prize in physics before I actually did it. I mean, that's astounding to me. So I think that they're much more politicized now than they used to be, but at least in economics, I mean, Paul Krugman did have a large body of work in the field, international trade and
I forget what the actual title is. I want to say geographical, spatial economics, I think was the actual name of the field, one of the things he was specialized in. And it was pretty good stuff. I mean, that's not my area, so I wasn't hip deep in the literature, but I mean, just even talking to other free market guys who can't stand Krugman's politics or his blog or his New York Times column, they said, no, back when Krugman was not so political and he was just cranking out academic papers, he was doing really good stuff. And so it's not ludicrous that he's a Nobel laureate for that work in economics, but what is, of course, a little bit suspicious is people were saying the timing of it, that it seemed like Krugman won that, when was it, in 08, I believe, when he had just been a huge critic of George Bush for all that time, and just, you know, a lot of people thought that looks kind of political, that they were giving it to him, so now, you know, to reward him, so now he has much more prestige and he can have a stronger hammer with which to beat down the Republicans. So whether that's true or not, I don't know. I'm not inside their head. But as far as prestige, I mean, it is what it is, that you have to be very good at mainstream academic research. So you can't just be some schlub who gets it. You know, it's not enough just to say, oh, I'm a Keynesian and I agree with government intervention and I'm going to win the Nobel Prize. No, you have to do formal work and so forth. You have to be recognized by your peers as a leader in a certain area. But I think it is true that they, even putting aside politics, when the committee knows that when somebody wins a Nobel Prize, that is going to be like a signal. And so then all of a sudden that person's work is going to be elevated in its prestige, and then whoever else is working in that field all of a sudden is going to be a big deal. And people who are trying to pick dissertation topics now are going to be more likely to pick topics related to this new area because now all of a sudden it's hot. So that's certainly true, and how can I say? Like experimental economics. When Vernon Smith gets the Nobel Prize, now all of a sudden experimental economics has been stamped with approval, and now it's okay to do that stuff, whereas before some people might have been real elitist and said, nah, experimental economics, what is this garbage? You know, let's do rigorous theory or something, or do econometric tests. You don't just have a bunch of undergrads in the lab getting paid $20 to decide whether they want to cooperate or defect with the Swiss summit. It is stupid. But no, now the Nobel Committee comes along and says that Vernon Smith wins the Nobel Prize for his pioneering work in experimental economics, then that's a big deal. And all of a sudden that gets stamped with approval. And so people, you know, up-and-comers getting their PhD in economics who are interested in experimental economics now can more confidently do a dissertation in that field and get hired, because now that's a cool, hip, acceptable field. All right. So where I'm going with this is to say the Nobel Committee is aware of that phenomenon, and so they might. It's not necessarily that they say every year, okay, who is the best economist out there who's done the most important work that has yet to receive a Nobel Prize and who's living, because you know, you have to be alive to get it. And then that's the way they pick the person. I think it's more they might work backwards and say, we want to give a Nobel Prize in a certain field. What field do we want to push? And then once they decide that, they say, okay, now within this field, if we're going to give a Nobel Prize in this area, who has to get it? And then it's pretty obvious who's got to get it if you're going to go give a prize in that area. So, for example, the people I was talking about before, the three good people, and their names are escaping me right now, that won it recently for their work in labor market theory. I mean, that I don't think it was a coincidence that they won that when we're in the midst of a really awful recession. I think that the committee was trying to encourage work in the analysis of labor markets and unemployment, how do we deal with this stuff? And so they gave their blessing to economists whose careers have been devoted to studying the formal analysis of labor markets. Okay. And I think we got one more question from Benjamin. It seems that Keynes is a government planner since his solutions involve the government manipulation and that he really does think people are stupid, in parentheses, they don't know the difference between nominal and real wages. Can you explain where I'm wrong in thinking this? Well, it's, I mean, this is a very controversial issue, obviously, and we will talk about this more in this upcoming week's lecture, Lecture 3, where we're going to talk about the last chapter from the general theory. So it is true that, how can I put it? Okay. First of all, the context for the most recent argument over this was that Hyatt Kane's rap video, the sequel, the, I think they call it Fight of the Century, you know, when they're showing them in a boxing ring. And there's a line in there where Hayek says something like, you know, I reject your central plan to the guy playing Keynes. And so a lot of modern Keynesians got huffy about that, saying, oh, that's not true. That's a caricature. Keynes was not a central planner. He didn't believe in socialism. In fact, that's a monstrous lie. Keynes' whole point was to say, if we don't implement some of these interventions that I'm recommending, then capitalism will fall. People, the masses, won't accept this large-scale, year-after-year massive unemployment, and they will demand socialists. You know, they will give their support to the dictator who rises up and promises them prosperity, because clearly a pure laissez-faire capitalist framework does not work. The masses will not be willing to wait around for 8 years starving while there's massive unemployment, because they believe in private property, and it's not going to work. And so you better embrace Keynesianism if you want to keep a classical liberal framework. All right, and Keynes himself says that in the last chapter. But it's also true, as Benjamin's saying, Keynes says some pretty interventionist stuff in that last chapter too, talking about the socialization of investment. So it's not just, oh, let's have progressive income tax rates and then have some social spending here and there, provide subsidies for underprivileged kids to get a college degree. No, Keynes is saying the government should take over investment, or at least take over large portions of it and set the broad parameters of how it's going to work. I mean, that's pretty, you know, so he's not a central planner in the sense that he wants to drop a five-year plan and literally take over all the means of production and have outright state socialism, but it is also along the spectrum towards the fascist model, where, yeah, he retains nominal private property ownership, but the government can tell those so-called private owners what to do with their property. I mean, what else would socialization of investment mean besides the government taking over responsibility for how resources are invested? So, yeah, and he wants, and we'll talk about this too, Keynes wants to push down the interest rate to basically zero. and so it's, I think what Keynes, so the defender of Keynes would say that's not central planning. Keynes still wants to give the man on the spot the discretion to say which particular things are we going to invest in. But the terms on which the investment happens are going to be with an interest rate of basically zero, as opposed to an interest rate of 6%. Excuse me. So, and the same thing too with massive government deficit spending. Modern Keynesians say, no, that's not central planning. Keynes is just saying we need to ensure that there's sufficient aggregate demand. But then within that framework, we still have market prices and we still have entrepreneurs deciding whether to open a shopping mall here or whether to open a movie theater down here. It's just the government has to be there to ensure that total demand is high enough to provide full employment. But then what it is that those workers are actually doing, that's still determined by market forces. But the point is, so the composition of the workforce, the employed workforce, is determined by market forces, the price system, but the volume of total employment, they're going to say, is something that the government has to maintain because, as Keynes has so brilliantly pointed out, left to its own devices, the market could get stuck in an equilibrium where only 80% of the workforce is employed. And it's true, of the people with jobs, they're going to be efficiently allocated. You know, given that only 80% of the workforce is going to have a job, those 80% are allocated properly because of the efficient market, but the 20% might be out of work indefinitely. And so that's what they would say. So Benjamin, it depends what you want to call central planning. It's true, Keynes is not like Lenin or something. I mean, he's not literally saying let's have the government main or seize control of all the means of production and come up with a 5-year plan where the government says to these workers, okay, you guys go to this factory, you go here, we're going to produce this many widgets, we're going to produce this many automobiles. He doesn't say that, but he also is a lot further along the road to that than just saying we're going to have a progressive income tax and we're going to have some social safety net programs. No, he's much more specific about the outcomes that the government is going to ensure. And then as far as your stuff about workers being stupid, there it's a little bit nuanced. So Keynes is definitely an elitist. He certainly thinks he's smarter than most people and that's why he needs to be telling the government what to do to advise people. But it's also the case on that particular issue, even though he does say workers would resist nominal wage cuts, but they would be willing to go along with a reduction in the purchasing power of their wage because of general price inflation. He's not saying that to show how stupid the workers are. He says later on in that chapter, so that's from chapter 2, he says later on why that actually makes sense. All right, so he's saying there that the classical economists who would diagnose that as being silly and an example of money illusion, it's the classical economists who are foolish, and actually the workers and the unions are smart. So there it's a little bit nuanced. That Keynes thinks there's valid reasons for them behaving like that, and it's rational. Okay. And then Peter LaRue has the final comment here, and I'll read that and then we'll have to stop for today. He says, last week I spoke to a South African Reserve Bank director who advocated exactly this lowering of interest rates below what the market would set so that the people can have access to resources that the free market wouldn't allow them. He wasn't Lenin either, but he wanted to centrally tweak just like Keynes. Yeah, and I mean this is the whole thing about the supposed progressive vision that, oh yeah, we can't have pure laissez-faire capitalism because that's poor people would starve to death and guys in rich cars and top hats would be telling everyone what to do, and that'd be an awful system. But we're also not naive. We also have seen the 20th century that outright socialism doesn't work either. So we're going to have the middle road. We're going to have a basically market economy, but with humane interventions in place to trim the excesses of it. You know, we can't just have raw capitalism because that's too brutal. So we want to retain the efficiency of capitalism, its benefits in the sense of harnessing individual initiative. We want brilliant guys like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and so forth out there doing their thing, inventing new stuff or coming up with seeing new profitable opportunities and so forth. But we also have to be compassionate and look out for the little guy and have some regulation in place to make sure that these harsh outcomes don't fall on any particularly unfortunate sector of society. So yeah, that's the whole shtick of interventionism, which Mises famously thought was a non-viable alternative, that you're going to go one way or the other. Interventionism, the so-called mixed economy, is unstable, that it's just going to keep generating problems that the interventionists are then going to use as a pretext for expanding government power until you're finally inexorably pushed towards socialism. Okay, well, we're over time. Let me stop there. So good session, guys. Good questions, Benjamin, and thank you for the comment there, Peter. And I will. So I'm going to, again, I will send out an email officially telling you guys when Wednesday's lecture will start. It'll probably be just an hour pushed back because, again, I'm flying to Vegas that day, and I'm just not sure I can get to the hotel and get set up in time to start at the regularly scheduled time. But I will let you know for sure one way or the other. Okay, so thanks, guys. I guess apparently I'll see some of you guys at Freedom Fest. See you or talk to you next week.